as many before him, Huey missed entirely the brilliant Greek insight that reading and understanding are two different things. Good reading is the fluent and effortless cracking of the symbol sound code, which puts understanding within easy reach. Understanding is the translation of that code into meaning. It is for many people a natural and fairly harmless mistake. Since they read for meaning, the code cracking step is forgotten. Forgotten, that is, by those who read well. For others, self-disgust and despair, engendered by a halting process in decoding sounds, sets into play a fatal chain of circumstances which endangers the relationship to print for a long time, sometimes wrecking it forever. If decoding is a painful effort, filled with frustrating errors, finally a point is reached when the reader says, in effect, to the devil with it. Another piece of dangerous philosophy is concealed inside whole word practice. The notion that a piece of writing is only an orange one squeezes in order to extract something called meaning, some bit of data. The sheer luxury of putting your mind in contact with the greatest minds of history across time and space, feeling the rhythm of their thought, the sallies and retreats, the marshaling of evidence, the admixture of humor or beauty of observation, and many more attributes of the power and value language possesses, has something in common with being coached by Bill Walsh in football or Toscanini in orchestra conducting. How these men say what they say is as important as translating their words into your own. The music of language is what poetry and much rhetoric are about, the literal meaning often secondary. Powerful speech depends on this understanding. By 1920, the sight word method was being used in new wave progressive schools. In 1927, another professor at Columbia Teachers College, Arthur Gates, laid the foundation for his own personal fortune by writing a book called The Improvement of Reading, which purported to muster 31 experimental studies proving that sight reading was superior to phonics. All these studies are either trivial or highly ambiguous at best, and at times, in a practice widely encountered throughout higher education research in America, Gates simply draws conclusions he wants from the facts which clearly lead elsewhere. But his pièce de résistance is a comparison of first-grade deaf pupils tutored in the whole-word method with Detroit first-graders. The scores of the two groups are almost identical, causing Gates to declare this a most convincing demonstration. Yet it had been well known for almost a century that deaf children taught with a method created expressly for deaf children only gain a temporary advantage which disappears quickly. In spite of this cautionary detail, Gates calls this conclusive proof that normal children taught this way would improve even faster. Shortly after the book's publication, Arthur Gates was given the task of authoring Macmillan's Basal Reader Series, a pure leap into whole word method by the most prestigious education publisher of them all. Macmillan was a corporation with wide-reaching contacts able to enhance an author's career. In 1931, Gates contributed to the growth of a new reading industry by writing an article for Parents Magazine, New Ways of Teaching Reading. Parents were told to abandon any residual loyalty they might have to the barren former older method and to embrace the new as true believers. A later article by a Gates associate was expressly tailored for those parents concerned because children do not know their letters. It explained that the modern approach to reading eliminated the boredom of code cracking. With its finger in the wind, Scott Forsman, the large educational publisher, ordered a revision of its Elson Basic Readers drawn on the traditional method, a series which had sold 50 million copies to that date. To head up the mighty project, the publisher brought in William S. Gray, Dean of the University of Chicago College of Education, to write its all-new whole-word pre-primer and primer books, a series marking the debut of two young Americans who would change millions of minds into mush during their long tenure in school classrooms. Their names were Dick and Jane. After Gates and Gray, most major publishers fell into line with other whole word series, and in the words of Rudolf Flesch, inherited the kingdom of American education with its fat royalties. Blumenfeld does the student of American schooling a great service when he compares the original 1930 Dick and Jane with its 1951 successor. Quote, in 1930, the Dick and Jane pre-primer taught 68 sign words in 39 pages of story text, with an illustration per page, a total of 565 words, and a teacher's guidebook of 87 pages. In 1951, the same book was expanded to 172 pages, with 184 illustrations, a total of 2,603 words, and a guidebook of 182 pages to teach a sight vocabulary of only 58 words. Without admitting any disorder, the publisher was protecting itself from the system, and the general public, without quite knowing why, was beginning to look at its schools with unease. By 1951, entire public school systems were bailing out on phonics and jumping onto the sight-reading bandwagon. Out of the growing number of reading derelicts poised to begin tearing the schools apart, which tormented them, a giant remedial reading industry was spawned, a new industry completely in the hands of the very universities who had with one hand written the new basal readers, and with the other taught a generation of new teachers about the wonders of the whole word method. Mute evidence that Scott Foresman wasn't just laughing all the way to the bank, but was actively trying to protect its nest egg in Dick and Jane, was its canny multiplication of words intended to be learned. In 1930, the word look was repeated 8 times. In 1951, 110 times. In the earlier version, O repeats 12 times. In the later, 138 times. In the first, C gets 27 repetitions, and in the second, 176. The legendary children's book author Dr. Seuss, creator of a string of bestsellers using a controlled, quote, scientific vocabulary supplied by the publisher, demonstrated his own awareness of the mindlessness of all of this in an interview he gave in 1981. I did it for a textbook house, and they sent me a word list. That was due to the Dewey Revolt in the 20s. In which they threw out phonics reading and went to a word recognition system as if you're reading a Chinese pictograph instead of blending sounds or different letters. I think killing phonics was one of the greatest causes of illiteracy in the country. Anyway, they had it all worked out that a healthy child at the age of 4 can only learn so many words in a week. So there were 223 words to use in this book. I read the list 3 times and I almost went out of my head. I said, I'll read it once more, and if I can find 2 words that rhyme, that'll be the title of my book. I found cat and hat and said, the title of my book will be The Cat in the Hat. Close quote. For the 41 months beginning in January of 1929 and concluding in June of 1932, there were 88 articles written in various pedagogical journals on the subject of reading difficulties and remedial teaching. In the 41 months beginning in July of 1935 and concluding in December of 1938, the number rose almost 200% to 239. The first effects of the total victory of the whole word reading philosophy were being reflected in academic journals as the once mighty reading Samson of America was led eyeless to Gaza with the rest of the slaves.